This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Millie wird bei uns einziehen.
Hallo?
Basierend auf dem weltweiten Bestseller.
Soll ich Ihnen alles zeigen? Sie sollen sich hier sicher fühlen. Das tue ich.
Mit Sydney Sweeney.
Sie sind meine Rettung. Was würde ich nur ohne Sie tun?
Und Amanda Seyfried. The Housemaid, wenn sie wüsste. Ab 15. Januar im Kino.
How many public inquiries are currently underway in the UK? 25. The most ever, and 6 have been announced so far in 2025. They're often lengthy, sometimes lasting several years, expensive. The COVID inquiry had cost north of £175 million by this summer, and contentious. And yet, it sometimes seems everybody wants one. Right now, it's the problems with the grooming gangs inquiry that's hitting the headlines. But the questions that it and the fashion for inquiries raise are whether we hold the right kinds of inquiries for the right reasons and whether there might be a better way of doing things. Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. We'll start with the grooming gangs inquiry as our most recent example. The briefing room's Caroline Bailey spoke to the BBC special correspondent Judith Moritz, who's been following the grooming gang story since 2012, and asked her why the inquiry is happening now, 2 decades on.
There have been inquiries before relating to grooming. You remember perhaps the local approach taken to the inquiry in Rotherham, which was chaired by Professor Alexis Jay in 2014. And then at the other end of the scale, also chaired by Alexis Jay, the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse, ICSA, which ran for 7 years. That was an enormous inquiry. But it's widely held that neither of those models of inquiry, either the local kind or the very much larger ICSA, dealt with laser focus on the subject of group-based child sexual exploitation, grooming gangs, in other words, on a national footing. And there's been a call for that over many years, but specifically this year, just to fast forward, and this really is in short order, you'll remember the political ping-pong at the start of this year when Elon Musk waded into the row about this, saying that, you know, that the Prime Minister should have called a national inquiry, the government was resisting doing that, initially saying it was going to commission more local inquiries. But critically, they asked the veteran Whitehall troubleshooter Baroness Louise Casey to conduct a rapid 3-month audit into the scale and nature of grooming gangs. And it was her report in June of this year which recommended a national inquiry. That is why we are now where we are, because it's that national inquiry which the government then agreed to hold, which is being, well, at the moment it's being set up, it's being cast, it's being organised. We're not at the point yet of hearings having begun, but even before we're across the starting line, there have been issues.
So what is the current row about?
Well, we're still, as I say, we're still in the pre-inquiry consultation phase, but critical to that, the government said that the views of victims and survivors of grooming gangs would be given a central role in helping to set the inquiry up. So there's been what's essentially a liaison panel of victims and survivors, which has been meeting in the background with officials from the Home Office and elsewhere, taking soundings from some of those whose experiences as children are the very reason for the inquiry in the first place. The row all started just over a week ago when it became obvious that things weren't going well backstage because 4 members of that survivors panel all tendered their resignations. They've all got similar concerns. They, on one hand, are unhappy with the prospective candidates for chair of the inquiry. They're also unhappy, they say, about restrictions placed on them in terms of what they can say publicly. And perhaps above all of that, they've been speaking very much about their concern that this inquiry will end up being watered down, that this inquiry will take a wider remit than just grooming gangs. It'll go beyond that and look at other forms of group-based child sexual exploitation. And that's what's bothering them.
But is it about personalities and politics, or is it about the structure of the inquiry that's really upsetting them?
I think it's a bit of everything. I think the first thing is structurally, We don't know exactly what this inquiry is going to look like. In fact, what we kind of know is what people don't want it to look like. Baroness Louise Casey recommended it, and in the same breath as saying it was necessary, she said this inquiry should not look like other public inquiries. She doesn't want it to be an overarching judge-led process. She was suggesting instead that what it should be is a series of local investigations directed and overseen by a national commission with statutory powers. That's her view. Now, some of these survivors have been saying that they actually, on the other hand, quite contrary to Louise Casey, would like this to be judge-led. They've taken umbrage at the suggestion that the chairperson may come from a policing background or a social work background. In fact, two of the candidates who were in the running to be the chair of this withdrew last week because the survivors said they were unhappy that they had exactly that kind of professional background. They say it's just too close to home when state agencies, including the police and social services, are amongst those who've had very public failings in this area. There are other survivors, we know, who've said, absolutely, we think that a chairperson should come from that kind of occupational background because it brings relevance to the role. So there's disagreement on almost every front.
Is there any sense of what they really want to achieve in all of this?
I've spent time talking to a range of different survivors, and they would each answer that question differently. And that perhaps is the problem. And I've spoken to one woman who lives in Bradford. She says, I live in an area which has not really been the subject of any kind of examination. I know that grooming gangs are very active, or have been very active, in the area where I live, but we were not covered by the other inquiries like the ones into Rochdale and Rotherham. So she wants her local area to be given a real focus. There are other survivors who are less bothered by that, but are really very, very firm on the issue of ethnicity. And that, of course, has been a very sensitive point as well. You can go back to Professor Alexis Jay's inquiry. That was another public inquiry in Rotherham 2014, when she herself said that the 1,400 girls in Rotherham had been victims of grooming gangs, which were predominantly of Pakistani heritage. And that is an issue which has been avoided over the years. Louise Casey, in her recent audit, which led to this inquiry, again said this is not a subject which has been dealt with and examined properly. So ethnicity is at the front of the list for others.
Judith Moritz. And before we move on, a plug for the Briefing Room podcast. If you visit BBC Sounds, you can access the entire back catalogue, such as the one which asks whether there's likely to be a global stock market crash, or the one on ID cards. Now, back to public inquiries. To find out how they've evolved and how well or not they actually work, I'm joined by Deborah Coles, Executive Director of the charity Inquest, Emma Norris, Director of Policy and Politics at the IPPR Think Tank and Senior Fellow at the Institute for Government, and Professor Lucy Easthope, an emergency planner and responder and visiting professor at the Centre for Death and Society at the University of Bath. First, Emma Norris, let's do a quick bit of history. Can you pick out a few of the significant recent public inquiries for us?
Sure. I mean, I think lots of different inquiries bring different things or tell different parts of the story. If we look pre-2005, you've got the Bichat inquiry, which was an inquiry into awful murder of two young girls, Holly Wells and Jessica Chapman, by their school caretaker. And this looked at how somebody with such a troubling past had been able to obtain employment in a school. And it stands out for a couple of reasons, because of its speed and its effectiveness. It was non-statutory. It took under a year to report. It wasn't led by a judge. And it managed to secure really lots of change across the child protection system. So it's quite different to your kind of standard inquiry. Then you have inquiries at the other end of the spectrum. So Bloody Sunday comes to mind, known as the Savile Inquiry, which was looking at British soldiers who shot and killed 13 civil rights protesters during a march in Derry in Northern Ireland. And the inquiry itself did manage to eventually secure an apology from the Prime Minister, but it took 12 years from 1998 until 2010. It cost £200 million. And the view was that it was far too long. It cost too much money. And actually, the government didn't really have the tools it needed to try and ensure that it moved faster and cost less money. So that was one of the inquiries that then led to the introduction of some kind of changes in legislation, the way that inquiries are done. You've got the Hillsborough independent panel from 2009, which was re-examining the kind of circumstances surrounding the 1989 Hillsborough Stadium disaster. And unlike your kind of standard statutory inquiry, it was non-statutory. It was about reviewing an enormous amount of documentary evidence that pertained to what had happened with the disaster. It was chaired by the Bishop of Liverpool, Reverend James Jones. And it was really about transparency rather than apportioning blame, and had quite a different focus. I think everyone will have heard of the COVID inquiry, which was established in 2022. It's an enormous statutory inquiry held under the 2005 Act. It's covering an enormous amount of material, almost every aspect of the pandemic. And because of that, it's divided into modules. Its final hearing isn't due until next year. And we probably won't see the final report from the inquiry until 2027 or potentially even beyond that.
You said that in 2005, this prompted a change in the way we were going to deal with inquiries. Can you just take us through what happened in 2005?
In 2005, after a series of very long and very expensive inquiries, including the Bloody Sunday inquiry that was ongoing, there was a decision to introduce new legislation to guide inquiries and to try and give government a bit more control over length and how much they were costing, but crucially also to ensure that inquiries had statutory powers that would enable them to do things like compel evidence, compel people to come and give witness testimony and so on. And that was a really important moment in the history of inquiries. You could still run non-statutory inquiries.
What is the difference?
The main difference is that inquiries that are held under the 2005 Act enjoy a set of powers, including the power to force people to release documentation, to come and give verbal evidence. Non-statutory inquiries don't have that power. They rely on people cooperating. And that's the main difference. And it's one of the reasons that the public tend to feel strongly about the importance of statutory inquiries, because that has a set of powers that non-statutory inquiries don't.
Deborah Cos, you've done a lot of work with people who regard themselves as victims or been victims of various processes. What kind of inquiry is preferred?
There is a tendency to want a statutory public inquiry for precisely the reasons that Emma has outlined, because that is an opportunity to both play a meaningful part in the process, but also to compel people to give evidence, to cooperate with the inquiry. We are involved in a public inquiry into deaths in mental health services in Essex. That originally started as an independent review, but had to be converted to a public inquiry because of the lack of candour of staff and senior management within Essex Mental Health Trusts. And so a lot of time was wasted in that interim period. And, you know, those families are still enduring a process like, you know, the COVID families. These inquiries take a lot of time. And one of the challenges and one of the reasons for that is, in my view, because often the response of those who are being called to account is one of reputation management, one of obfuscation, and that is why we have been involved in the campaigning around a Hillsborough law to try and make these processes much swifter and fairer for those most affected.
Deborah, what is the Hillsborough law?
The Hillsborough law, I should give it its formal title, is the Public Office Accountability Bill, which has just been recently introduced into the parliamentary process. So there are two key principles about the accountability bill. One is about the introduction of a duty of candour on public authorities and public officials to assist in investigations, inquests and inquiries. It also expands the provision of legal aid for families going through an inquest where a public body is involved, thereby ending the inequality of arms that we too often see where families are unrepresented at inquests while state bodies benefit from unlimited taxpayer-funded legal support.
Explain this duty of candour to me, because I don't understand why people don't already have a duty of candour. And Does a duty of candour mean that if you're not candid, you can be prosecuted, or what happens to you?
I mean, absolutely. Within the public office accountability, which we know as Hillsborough Law, not only is there the statutory duty of candour, which means that you have to actively assist with, you know, inquiries and investigations and inquests, but also there is a criminal sanction if you don't. And I think what we hope is that that will actually lead to the kind of legal, cultural and policy change within the public inquiry process and improve the response to deaths and harm and injustice and make sure that justice is a lot swifter than it is at the moment. I mean, I think many people find it difficult to accept the fact that we need to legislate to try and ensure truth-telling. But the reality is, as we've seen through many of these public inquiries, that the default of the state and public bodies is very often to obscure and obfuscate and actually be so defensive as to frustrate the process of trying to ensure truth, accountability and justice.
We often hear this term judge-led inquiry, as if all inquiries should be led by judges. Is there a tendency for people to think that their inquiries, if they want them, should be led by a judge? And do you think that tendency is a good one?
No, I think what's important is that there is somebody who is able to manage what is a, you know, a complex legal process and needs to understand that families and victims need to be at the heart. And they need to also manage, of course, a huge array of lawyers representing, you know, very different issues. But I think, you know, I don't necessarily agree that it needs to be judge-led. The problem with public inquiries is that until you go through an appalling injustice or preventable deaths, you're thrown into a very alien, unknown system. And actually, we could do a lot better in trying to ensure that people both understand the legal processes and what is most appropriate for the given situation. Because I think the tendency for successive governments is that you set up a public inquiry to try and assuage, you know, disquiet and, you know, legitimate concerns about deaths and harms and injustice. And my concern about public inquiries is that we seem to go from public inquiry to public inquiry, and we never actually stop and review how the inquiry was run. What was good practice? What did those most affected think about the process? What learning could we bring together to ensure that the next inquiry that is set up is better and doesn't just repeat some of the kind of failings?
Lucy Easthope, you're an emergency planner. You deal with disasters and you deal with victims and their families. How do you find that victims and their families respond to the kind of inquiries that they're getting?
Well, more and more, I think there's a lot of hope that comes with the announcement of an inquiry. And there's a certain standard now expected that it will be judge-led, it will be a statutory inquiry. And they very much buy into the phrases used by politicians when they are established, like this is the way to get truth, but also vindication, clarification, and ultimately justice. And they are not the vehicle for that. And one of the things that I'm very clear about is the learning is done. They serve purposes, but the purposes are oversold to families. And that's a real concern sometimes for me.
Right. Well, that's very interesting. Are public inquiries really for them? I mean, I'm picking up here a possible tension between essentially what families and victims might hope to get out of an inquiry and what might be actually the purpose of an inquiry, which will often be to try and put things right that have gone wrong.
One of the things I've tried to do very much in the public domain was actually show the little bits of learning that do happen continuously between disasters and actually take those to family groups and show the difference. And in fact, one of the most powerful things that we saw in sadly the last month was reflections on how much practice had changed between the bombings in the Manchester Arena and the attack on the Manchester Synagogue. And, you know, in amongst all the other necessary analysis of this, emergency responders were able to show what they took, learned and did differently. And my very personal experience is that does mean something to families.
Emma, Are we ever going to get away from inquiries that take years and cost tens of millions of pounds?
I think some inquiries genuinely do need to take a long time. They're getting to grips with really complex issues, often things that happened a long time ago. A focus on catharsis, centering people's experiences means that sometimes they do need to take years to get to grips with that. But there has been a trend towards them taking longer and costing more. Often that's down to scope. As you can see with the COVID inquiry, it's got an enormous scope. It's covering almost every aspect of the pandemic.
Deborah, from your point of view, what happens at the end of a public inquiry when a long list of recommendations is published in the final report? Are you anticipating that they will be implemented?
At the moment, there is a serious accountability gap whereby it is very, very difficult to find out what has happened on the ground to try and ensure that those recommendations result in meaningful change. And this is absolutely fundamental to those who have gone through those inquiry processes in the hope that things will change so that nobody else goes through a similar experience. And at the moment, we have a fragmented approach to scrutiny, which often means that it's siloed in, you know, by maybe an individual select committee or one government department, when what is needed is a holistic approach, because often these recommendations cut across government departments and public bodies who must be working together.
Are you saying, Deborah, there's no requirement for recommendations to be followed? I mean, you make the committee, an inquiry makes the recommendations, a government looks at them, or whoever looks at them maybe does some of them, maybe doesn't do others of them, but there's absolutely nothing to compel.
That's absolutely right. There's no, you know, legal enforcement powers. And I think the other problem is that, of course, when an inquiry finishes, that's it. And so one of the problems is that, you know, media interest may well be lost. It easily falls from the political agenda once that media interest is dissipated. And that can create a culture of complacency. And it's often left to those most affected, the victims, the families, the survivors, to be, in a way, that kind of oversight. You know, they're the ones who are chasing up what has actually happened to these recommendations, because the judge or the inquiry chair has no powers after that inquiry has closed.
Lucy, I think you were saying earlier that from your experience, though there is no compulsion for recommendations to be implemented, that doesn't mean that people can't learn things from the inquiries and from their recommendations about how to change practice.
Absolutely. And a big part of my work, I think, is navigating the change that happens. And I think people do find it quite positive sometimes. So lessons identified, we don't really say learned, but lessons identified at something like the bombings in 2005 in London informed a process that we call a joint interoperability between emergency responders. And that then was critiqued again at the arena. And so one of the things that we do is look at how we take those recommendations. And one is that the public and the families, crucially, that the families and the survivors never get to see, is actually how emergency responders listen to the inquiry hearings. So we don't wait necessarily for the reports. We listen to the evidence given.
Deborah, how often do we see prosecutions as a consequence of public inquiries?
I think the answer there is virtually none. You know, we've already discussed the long history of public inquiries and, you know, looking at the number of prosecutions or, you know, disciplinary processes or dismissals. I mean, it is virtually none. And I think for many families, that's a problem, because where there's no accountability or, you know, effectively impunity, there is a system where there is a danger of it repeating its failures.
Lucy, can you take us through some of the complications here?
Certainly a public inquiry can mess with, for want of a better word, criminal process, criminal disclosure, and can lead to accusations that there won't be a fair trial, which certainly interfered with the family's pursuit of justice at Hillsborough.
Emma, how political are inquiries? In the sense, how much are they a response to, if you like, a kind of pressure of demand from media and therefore the public, and how much are they a consequence of a perceived need to try and change something?
So honestly, I think that they are both. And there's often a big overlap between those two things. So I think that means that ministers both see public inquiries as a genuine tool for accountability, a way of signalling that there is real gravity to the issue and that they can lead to change. But I think they are also a way of sometimes managing the politics. And that's where you can sometimes see difficult choices not made up front. So if you take an example like the COVID inquiry, we could have said we're going to do something that's a little more narrow, quite focused, is going to report within a year and tell us how government needs to urgently change for the next pandemic. Or you can do something enormous that covers every aspect of the pandemic, that gives people that reassurance, but that as a result costs an enormous amount of money, takes a long time. There are legitimate arguments both sides, but if you fail to have that discussion up front and you promise everything, then you end up disappointing people. And sometimes I think the kind of politics of public inquiries means that those difficult conversations are not had up front.
Deborah.
I think sometimes it can be politically expedient of government to try and, you know, kick things into the long grass by saying they're going to set up a public inquiry.
Can we look at some of the longer term solutions? We've hinted at some of them, but I want to go into them in a little bit more depth. But the first one is, Emma, can we look at better overseas models for inquiries and what they do and how we might copy them?
I think that we could learn a lot from, say, a country like New Zealand that has accepted that people want statutory inquiries. They need the reassurance of inquiries having legal powers. But beneath that, they provide more choice. So rather than just having one model that often takes a lot of time and costs a lot of money, they provide a range of different statutory options, from some really fast policy-focused style reviews that take under a year, and to much longer and more expansive inquiries that are really trying to get to grips with, you know, an entire issue, tell the story and create a sense of catharsis, but still, to be honest, take a lot less time than our inquiries tend to. And I think that that would provide both reassurance but on legal powers, but a kind of broader range of options for ministers to draw from.
Emma, how do they decide in New Zealand which is appropriate for which? Because you can see that being a big problem here in Britain.
So that's the other piece that's quite different in New Zealand, in that there's a lot more advice provided to ministers on how they work through those choices. And that's something that we should think about importing as well. I think the other really interesting international example is how others deal with accountability. So in Australia, they often appoint implementation monitors once an inquiry has taken place, an individual with a lot of expertise in the area who will then oversee that implementation is happening, hold people and organisations to account. Even in Northern Ireland, they have started to use the equivalent of the National Audit Office to oversee inquiry recommendations. So I think we can learn from others on not just getting the inquiry set up right, but ensuring that we hold organisations to account for implementing what they recommend.
That's all we've got time for. My thanks to Emma Norris, Lucy Easthope, Deborah Coles and Judith Moritz. And my conclusion, wouldn't it be great if we could be clearer on what we want these inquiries to achieve? We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Kirstine Knight and Cordelia Hemming. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundele. The sound engineer was Duncan Hannant. And the editor was Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon.
How did Bruce Springsteen become the boss? And what did it cost him to get there?
Maybe I was the guy that gets the guitar, I get the car, I get the girl. Then it adds up to a big so what.
From the makers of the award-winning first season of Legend, join me, Laura Barton, for the story of my favourite artist, Bruce Springsteen. We'll get to know the life beyond the legend, to discover how a scrawny, long-haired introvert from small-town New Jersey transformed into the iconic rock star figure of his 80s glory.
We're all going, he has muscles now, which was a little hard to take because we were scrawny. Do we have to go get muscles?
Legend, the Bruce Springsteen story from BBC Radio 4. Listen first on BBC Sounds.